coming up on the Sunshine Economy, the Americas, and Miami. There was a time in South Florida when Latin America just meant Cuba and a trade embargo.
But these days, Latin America means a trade explosion with an entire hemisphere, Colombia, Chile, Mexico, Peru, and especially Brazil.
Still, all that thriving commerce comes against the backdrop of dramatically changing relations between Latin America and the United States.
The region's new economic and diplomatic clout has encouraged its leaders to challenge Washington's influence and welcome China's presence as never before.
That has many wondering if this will be the century of the Americas or a moment when the decades-old dream of North-South integration burns out like an old Cuban cigar. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Tim Padgett.
That's ahead on the Sunshine Economy, the Americas, and Miami on WLRN.
I turn now to a prospect of great promise, our hemispheric relations. Last month in Latin America, I saw for myself the quickening of hope, the revival of confidence, the new trust in our country among workers and farmers, as well as diplomats.
I firmly believe, juntos podemos lograr más. Together we can achieve more.
President Kennedy in 1962 declaring America's commitment to Latin America, and President Obama 51 years later, just last week, in fact, reiterating that pledge during his visit to Mexico. Latin America is a far more democratic region today with many more capitalist economies than it was a half century ago. But in many ways, the United States and Latin America have never felt more disconnected despite record levels of trade between them. So is the idea of North-South integration known as the Americas still viable today? What does it mean for us here in South Florida generally, particularly Miami, the economic and cultural nexus of North and South? Welcome to the Sunshine Economy, the Americas and Miami. It's the first edition of a series of WLRN programs exploring South Florida's economic horizons. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Tim Padgett. As the U.S. economy continues its swoon while much of Latin America continues to boom, America's influence south of its borders appears to be at an all-time low. Emerging powers like Brazil and populist leaders like Venezuela's recently deceased president, Hugo Chavez, have steered the region in a more independent trade and diplomatic direction. Whether it involves our lack of engagement with Cuba or Latin America's skyrocketing trade with communist China.
This is part of a dialogue, and you can join us, the conversation on WRN.org or on Twitter at WLRN. Use the hashtag Sunshine Economy. We'll get to your comments throughout the program. Tim, you've spent better than a quarter of a century covering this region of the world and looking at this relationship. Is the America's dream dead? Back in 2001, it was President Bush that declared this the century of the Americas. It really hasn't turned out that way.
Well, Tom, U.S. Latin America relations have always been uneasy. Ever since the days of the Monroe Doctrine two centuries ago, Washington has always been more than a little insensitive about Latin America's interests, and Latin America has always been more than a little hypersensitive about the U.S.'s dominance in the hemisphere. But despite all that, diplomats and academics and journalists like me, we've always clung to this notion that the New World was a shared project between North America and Latin America. And the age-old assumption was that as Latin America began to develop, as countries like Brazil are now doing, that would simply strengthen. Well, as you just pointed out, it really didn't work out that way. And that was pretty evident at the last summit of the Americas last year in Colombia, which didn't even produce a final declaration because there were so many disagreements between the U.S. and the rest of the hemisphere on issues like the drug war.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is, Tom, geography is destiny. And the United States and Latin America no more extricate themselves from each other than, say, Europe and the Arab world can. And our robust two-way trade, as you point out, is evidence of that. So this, in a sense, this is the century of the Americas, in the sense that Latin America is now coming into its own, and we have to learn how to deal with that.
You talked about trade, and that trade continues to strengthen and grow almost each and every day, and we see evidence of it on the streets and in the businesses here in South Florida. Hewlett-Packard, American Airlines, UPS, Oracle, Microsoft all have their Latin American headquarters based right here in South Florida. This is a significant driver of the local economy. And Tim, you'd have to agree, a significant interest for South Floridians in improving and building upon the relationship that does exist between these two continents.
Well, and there's so many issues right now that are driving a wedge between the United States and Latin America, despite all that robust trade. One of them, for example, is immigration, which we're now seeing playing out in Washington. This is an issue that matters not just to Mexicans. It matters to Central Americans. It matters to South Americans because they see it as a gauge of how interested and willing the United States is to engage the rest of this hemisphere in terms of a sensical flow of immigration between the two parts of this hemisphere.
And we're going to engage in a wide-ranging discussion over the next hour, looking at other wedge issues, the growth of the Brazilian economy being one of them. We're going to be looking, of course, at generations of the drug war and what that has done to the relationship between the United States and Latin America. And of course, Tim, if there's one country really playing the go-between between the U.S. and Latin America these days, it's got to be Colombia.
I would agree.
Yeah, it's Washington's closest ally on the continent, thanks in part to the billions and billions of dollars in U.S. aid that's helped the country turn the tide against its drug trafficking Marxist guerrillas.
And the man responsible for helping to manage the U.S.-Colombia relationship for Colombia is Carlos Urrutia. He's the Colombian ambassador to the United States, and we spoke with him recently about his job.
Ambassador, thanks for joining us. Colombia and your president, Juan Manuel Santos, are widely regarded as really an important go-between between Latin America and the U.S. Bogota and Washington just completed that first anniversary of a very significant free trade agreement. Of course, it was also launched during last year's Summit of the Americas in Colombia, where your president and also other Latin American leaders were really unusually frank about the disagreements the U.S. has had with Latin America on a number of issues. How have U.S.-Latin American relations changed, in your opinion? And does the idea of the Americas still have a future?
Well, I believe it does have a future. The fact is that, as you correctly point out, President Santos has been playing a leading role in, if you will, facilitating relations between the Latin American nations and the United States. So we have a lot at stake in Latin America. It is our region, and we are increasingly engaging in not only policy matters, but things like trade, investment, many, many matters of cooperation among the various nations of Latin America. And Colombia has been bridging certain gaps that may have existed in relations between the U.S. and the region. And I believe that things are working well and that progress has indeed been made.
Ambassador, what are the most important issues you see Colombia helping to facilitate in terms of dialogue between the United States and Latin America?
Well, certainly in issues of, in certain cases, issues of governance, for instance. I think, for instance, I'd like to point to the fact that President Santos played an important role in bringing together the nations of South America with recently elected President Maduro in a meeting that took place in Lima to make it a point that President Maduro and the Venezuelan new government would agree to hold at least an auditing process with respect to the electoral results in the recent Venezuela presidential election. So that's one aspect that is important. But otherwise, you know that only a year ago, in April of last year, the meeting of the Summit of the Americas was held in Colombia, and many issues were brought to the attention of the U.S. and the nations of Latin America, including the aspect of opening a broad discussion on the issue of the war against drugs, and it's about to come to fruition with a report that is to be submitted soon by the OAS.
Ambassador, there's also a lot of buzz today about what they call the, quote, decoupling of the United States and Latin America, about China's incursion into the hemisphere, and about Latin American countries, Colombia included, looking more and more beyond the U.S. for trade partners. Colombia, for example, is hosting a summit this month of the new Pacific Alliance. And yet total trade between the U.S. and Latin America hit a record $1 trillion last year. What's the reality here?
Well, the reality is that as far as Colombia is concerned, The U.S. continues to be our most important trading partner. You know that the free trade agreement was implemented in May of last year and is the 15th of May this year, reaching its first anniversary. Trade between the two countries is very dynamic and robust, has grown significantly in the course of just 1 year. And so with the figure that you just mentioned, it seems to me that it would not be fair to say that there is really a decoupling between the U.S. and Latin America. There may be frictions in certain areas, but the fact of the matter is that, the figures point otherwise, and there is an interest in many of the nations in Latin America to deepen and strengthen the relationship, not only a relation based on policies, but also on trade and investment.
Ambassador, I want to ask you about any friction you've been picking up within the United States. As you travel around the U.S. and talk with local and state officials and business leaders from different regions and different cities as they want to take advantage of this free trade agreement with the U.S. and Colombia, are you sensing more competition among U.S. cities to become that gateway into Latin America, a role that Miami has played for so many years?
No, I don't sense that, really. I think that everyone rightly every city, every business community rightly wants to have a piece of the action, but I don't see that there's a friction there. I think there is a virtuous circle rather than a vicious circle of friction.
Thank you very much, Ambassador Rutte. We very much appreciate you talking with us.
Robert Pastor joins us now. Robert is a former White House National Security Advisor for Latin America and Director of the Center for North American Studies at American University in Washington. He's also author of a new book entitled The North American Idea, A Vision of a Continental Future.
Bob, we've just heard Ambassador Carlos Urrutia from Colombia tell us that the U.S.-Latin America relationship is strong and that this idea of the Americas, this idea of North-South integration and partnership is viable. What do you think?
I think that I wish that were the case, but in fact, Latin America is now divided among countries that do believe in free trade, like Peru, Colombia, and Chile, and that are open to closer U.S. relations, and other countries that want to pursue a different approach under Mercosur, which is more protectionist. At the same time that has occurred, North America has developed into the largest free trade area in the world, and the U.S. interests are more centrally located economically with its two closest neighbors, Canada and Mexico, our first and second largest trading, first and second largest market for U.S. merchandise exports. North America exports half of all of its goods to just its three neighbors right now, which is twice what we export to Asia and three times what we export to Europe. So actually, the Americas are three different areas right now. One is North America, which is a powerful economic free trade area. The second are smaller countries in South America that are interested in freer trade with the United States and with the world. And the third are more protectionist element in South America that had also been more or less aligned with Hugo Chavez's view of the world. Now, of course, in the post-Chavez era, that's going to change, but still, the Americas, unfortunately, are not the free trade area of the Americas that was envisaged in 1994 when the Summit of the Americas was first established. That's no longer viable unless there are major changes that are underway.
And Bob, we just saw President Obama finish a trip to Mexico and Central America. Is the United States itself doing enough to engage the rest of the hemisphere and keep itself relevant in this hemisphere?
No, it is not. But President Obama's trip is a good first step to Mexico and to Central America. But he needs to do a lot more to open up and to show in a post-Chavez era America's interest in reengaging with the rest of South America. But, of course, Brazil needs to take the lead as well and decide which direction it wants to go, whether its purpose is to seek hegemony in South America or its purpose is to open the South American economy to the rest of the world and to the United States. That's not at all clear yet.
A lot of critics, Bob, have pointed that the Obama administration has been lacking in South America in terms of its engagement due to other foreign policy crises, especially those in the Mideast. We'll leave it there, Bob. Robert Pastor is a former White House National Security Advisor for Latin America and Director of the Center for North American Studies at American University in Washington. And you can join the conversation on WLRN.org or on Twitter at WLRN. Use the hashtag Sunshine Economy. Still to come on the Sunshine Economy, the Americas and Miami, how inflation in Brazil helps drive shoppers to South Florida.
America's public enemy number one in the United States is drug abuse.
Illegal cocaine is coming into our country at alarming levels.
We're pursuing drug dealers around the world and interdicting supply before it reaches our shores.
This is the Sunshine Economy, the Americas and Miami. I'm Tom Hudson.
Tim Padgett.
Richard Nixon there, Ronald Reagan, George W. Bush. Every U.S. president for the past 42 years has marshaled support for what critics call America's most unwinnable war, the drug war. And up to now, Latin America was content to let Washington call most of the shots. Today, though, as narco-violence ravages countries like Honduras, which, by the way, has the world's worst murder rate, few issues really illustrate Latin America's new assertive break with U.S. policy. As President Obama clearly, Tim, was reminded during his trip just last week through Mexico and Central America.
No, that's right. And on the one hand, a lack of reliable law enforcement and judicial systems in Latin America certainly plays a big role in this crisis. According to one new study, in fact, the world's 10 most dangerous cities are all in Latin America, and the economic and social costs are enormous. But increasingly, Latin American leaders say the real cause is America's insatiable appetite for illegal drugs, and they're staging a policy revolt of sorts, calling on Washington to spend less on interdiction abroad and more on reducing demand at home. At last year's Summit of the Americas in Cartagena, Colombia, as I mentioned before, they insisted that the U.S. at least discuss legalizing certain drugs as a way of depriving the cartels of some of their astronomical revenue. Uruguay, for example, legalized marijuana just last year.
At its heart, it is a supply and demand argument, as it has been for a better part of a generation. Millions of lives affected, billions of dollars spent. University of Miami's Bruce Bagley is along with us now, author of the demobilization of the Colombian paramilitaries between hope and skepticism. Professor, welcome to the Sunshine Economy. You've been following this drug war for years, the impact on U.S. Latin American relations. How has the hemisphere's thinking here recently changed on how to battle violent drug mafias?
I think if you take it in perspective, we have seen more than 40 years of a bloody and incredibly expensive, not just for the United States, but for Latin America, drug war, which has produced negative results, not positive results. There are more drugs, more readily available, cheaper in the United States, and by the way, increasingly in Latin America. So the rebellion that we're seeing, the opposition that we are seeing, really has to do with the fact that the prohibitionist model has cost them so much and produced so little, they want to search for alternatives, for different paradigms that do not impose such costs on them without imposing similar costs on the United States.
Bruce, the buzzword these days, not just in Latin America, but in the United States as well, as we saw last year in our own elections when the states of Colorado and Washington voted to legalize marijuana, legalization is the buzzword. And when you look at the rationale for it, there are studies that show that as much as a third, if not more, of the revenues that the vicious Mexican drug cartels make comes from marijuana trafficking. And if we were to legalize marijuana, which many people think is no more harmful a drug than alcohol if consumed moderately, if we were to legalize it, it would really deprive those cartels of a big chunk of the revenues that they use to wreak their mayhem. Is it really a viable solution?
Well, it's not a panacea. It's not a silver bullet. It's not going to solve all of the problems. But the driving force behind the drug trade are the billions of dollars in profits. Mm-hmm. If you can reduce the profits, say by 30%, by legalizing one of the major drugs that are trafficked in the hemisphere, marijuana, you could significantly reduce the profitability of a number of these cartels and hence reduce their firepower, their ability to corrupt governments and to undermine institutions. There would still be other drugs and a diversification of the organized crime problems, but it would be a step in the right direction and would be a symbolic step that Latin America, I think, would generally embrace.
But like any illicit business, it may go elsewhere. You cut a legitimate business by 30%, it's going to look for new opportunities somewhere else. Couldn't that same be said for this illicit trade in Latin America?
I think there's no question that increasingly they would focus, and perhaps even more violently than they already are, on things like cocaine and heroin, methamphetamines, ecstasy, and a variety of other prescription drugs. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't take the first step. There's going to be organized crime. If we can reduce the profitability of organized crime, we can reduce its negative impacts on human rights, on democracy, on governability in Latin America.
Bruce, one of your areas of expertise is Colombia, and for lack of a better word, the success relatively that it had in combating drug cartels. And a lot of people are saying that we should be looking to the Colombian model as a way to help Mexico out of its god-awful drug crisis. Are there lessons to be learned from the way we engaged Colombia for Mexico?
Well, the United States spent between 2000 and 2011 under Plan Colombia almost $8 billion. We've given Mexico, which is a country three times as big as Colombia, far less money, right. $1.4 billion. So, you know, the first point is that the Colombian experiment, if you want to put it that way, cost a huge amount of money that the United States is not in a position to put up. Second of all, the Colombians, particularly the governing elites of that country, began to realize that they needed institutions that actually worked. So they began from within to reform the institutions in Colombia. I'm not sure that the Mexicans have quite arrived at that point yet, but certainly you can learn that police reform, judicial reform, and I would add prison reform are essential to this process. So there's no question that there are some lessons, but let's not overstate the Colombian model, if you like, because sure. The Colombians are now confronting the rise of a new phenomena, which is called bandas criminales or right. criminal bands, and this entire process of BACRIM resurging on the basis of drug trafficking is in part, at least, the result of the push that is taking place in Mexico, driving drugs back into Central America and Colombia.
Take this again to the broader picture of the idea of the Americas. How has the drug war changed the trajectory of this engagement between the two hemispheres and changed the dialogue for where this idea of the Americas goes from here?
Well, I think that the Latin Americans have really reached a saturation point. They have had a U.S.-led war on drugs imposed on them for more than 40 years now. It has produced the results that we see, which is a widespread contamination of virtually every country in the region. That wasn't the case 40 years ago. So rather than positively impacting the region, it's negatively impacted the region and drawn in more and more countries, everywhere from Mexico to Patagonia. Brazil is now the second largest cocaine-consuming country in the world. Argentina is the third. In that sense, we've seen the spread of consumption in Latin America. We've seen an erosion of their institutions. They want to do something different.
And Peru, if I'm not mistaken, just surpassed Colombia as the leading cocaine producer in South America?
Well, they're like Hertz and Avis, you know, which one is first. But, you know, neither would really want to claim that championship. And right. The fact is that Colombia in the early 2000s was producing almost 90% of all the coca leaf, whereas in 1985, Peru was producing virtually 65%. Now Colombia and Peru are splitting roughly 45 to 50% each, with Bolivia dragging into third place.
Bruce, thanks very much. And you've got a new book coming out, you said, on drug trafficking in Latin America.
That's right.
Thank you.
It's the demobilization of the Colombian paramilitaries, Between Hope and Skepticism, the new book. It is the University of Miami's Bruce Bagley. Join our conversation on WLRN.org, on Twitter with the handle at WLRN. Use the hashtag The Sunshine Economy. Still ahead on The Sunshine Economy today, how business with China is changing how U.S. does business with Latin America. We'll be right back.
executive committee has decided to give not only the right, but the responsibility to organize FIFA's World Cup 2014 to the country Brazil.
I have the honor to announce that the games of the 31st Olympiad are awarded to the city of Rio de Janeiro.
This is the Sunshine Economy, the Americas and Miami. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Tim Padgett.
Now, that was the Carnival of Celebration, Tim, that we heard twice when Brazil first was picked to host the World Cup in 2014, then, of course, the Summer Games in 2016 in Rio. Really, no country here exemplifies Latin America's 21st century bid to step out of the U.S.'s shadow more than Brazil. A decade ago, of course, skeptics still remarked that South America and Brazil was the country of the future and always will be the country of the future, but really no longer. It's become the country of the moment, an emerging power, not only with the global economy, now the sixth largest in the world, but also diplomatically with Washington's first real counterweight in the Western Hemisphere, and one that doesn't clearly always see eye to eye with the U.S. administration on how to engage in everything from communist Cuba to Iran's nuclear energy program.
Despite that, though, Brazil has sambaed its way into Miami's heart. the country is South Florida's number one foreign commercial partner, doing $16.4 billion in total trade with us last year. Until recently, in fact, Tom, Brazil was creating almost 20 local currency millionaires each day, which is a big reason Brazilian buyers are widely credited with saving Miami's wrecked condominium market and for purchasing almost a tenth of the homes and apartments being sold in Miami-Dade County in recent years, to which Miamians can only say, muito obrigado, brasileiros. Thank you very much, Brazilians.
We've got the conversation going on WLRN.org, on Twitter as well, with the handle at WLRN. Use the hashtag Sunshine Economy. And Derek tweeted this just to the point of the commodity boom in Brazil here, Tim. How does the market for sugarcane across Latin America affect the Sunshine Economy here in South Florida?
Well, a lot of that depends on how long the subsidies for sugarcane cultivation here in South Florida and the Everglades continues, and that's a big bone of contention between countries like Brazil and the U.S.
Yeah, and it's more than just sugarcane, of course, with a commodity boom in Brazil, like a lot of Latin American countries. It's been very reliant on the global commodity demand and higher prices to fuel the Brazilian economic growth. But last year, the Brazilian economy actually fell by 1%. That slowdown, as well as a realization that it still has a lot of problems to fix, like inadequate infrastructure and weak rule of law, before the country can really call itself a developed, mature economy. And all this has Brazilians feeling anxious about the future for the first time this century.
Lourdes Garcia Navarro with NPR joins us now from São Paulo, Brazil. The Brazilian economy, Lourdes, is the sixth largest in the world today, but just a decade ago, it wasn't even in the top 10. So how has this changed how Brazilians feel about their country on the global stage?
Well, I think it's really changed their perceptions quite a bit. On the one hand, you know, Brazilians are, of course, very concerned with what's happening within their own country. This is an enormous country that covers a huge swath of territory. And in that sense, it's a lot like the United States. You know, people here don't speak foreign languages. They tend to travel within Brazil. And so they're like the United States. But they're also now looking for their place on the global stage. And, you know, Brazil has a great deal of goodwill in the world. You know, Brazilians will always tell you everywhere we go, they love us, whether it's because they know them for football or they know them for carnival. So they enjoy this kind of goodwill generally. And I think what's happened is we've seen successive Brazilian governments now leverage that. And so they act as these kind of intermediaries, if you will, on the one hand, engaging with the United States. And on the other hand, they form part of the BRICS. And so they are close allies to countries that perhaps don't see eye to eye with the United States. And so they have this enviable position right now where they have a great deal of stature, and they're leveraging that diplomatically and politically around the world.
But today, Lourdes, after a decade of boom, the likes of which this hemisphere has rarely ever seen, Brazilians are beginning to sense some angst for the first time, particularly in terms of stalled growth and rising inflation. Is that, causing some anxiety on the part of Brazilians at the same time?
Absolutely. You know, in the last decade, 40 million Brazilians joined the middle class. But that has been facilitated, for example, by Easy Credit. So for the first time, you're seeing people who never had access to credit cards now drowning in debt. You know, there's sky-high lending rates here, and some credit cards are charging 238%. And so basically we're seeing sort of Brazilians who are for the first time exercising their purchasing power, really struggling with how to manage it all. And so we're seeing rising prices, we're seeing credit card debt increasing, and I think that really has a lot of people here concerned.
And how are you seeing that manifest itself?
When you go shopping here, you'll see these prices, and there are big, bold numbers, you know, in red signs, and you go, wow, that's so cheap. And then you see underneath it a little times sign, and it's basically they do things here by parcela, which means they give it to you in installments. And so most people here sort of buy things, and the prices are very, very large compared to what you pay for things in the United States. And so people really are used to now spending quite a bit of money, and a lot of their money is going to servicing this debt. And so you talk to people, you know, regular Brazilians, and they really do complain a lot about prices. And I'm not just talking about consumer goods, things that you can voluntarily choose to spend on, but we're talking about tomatoes, onions, foodstuffs, things that are actually, you know, you need to buy in order to survive.
Lourdes, it sounds like the late night infomercials for the set of knives at $9.99, but you have to do four installments. But instead of knives, it's maybe a basket of onions or potatoes.
That's true. And, you know, you can't forget that, you know, here many people are not sophisticated users of credit cards. They're just newly exposed to this. It's a very nascent industry. For the first time, they are being exposed to this. And so they're buying these things in installments, and they're putting it on their credit cards, which are charging them enormous interest rates. And it all kind of snowballs. And so it's a real threat to, I think, some of the growth of the middle class. 28% of people's income here goes to servicing debt. That's compared to 16% in the United States. So just think about that. That's almost, you know, more than 10% higher.
And as a result, is Miami becoming more of a lure for Brazilians in terms of not just investment, but in terms of just shopping sprees on the weekends, for example? A couple of years ago, there were figures out that showed that Brazilians were buying about a tenth of the available houses and condos on sale in Miami during the crisis. Is there a sense that, you know, Miami and the United States is more and more the place for Brazilians to go with their money these days?
I think that that's absolutely right. A quick shopping trip to Miami is going to be beyond the means of most people here. But certainly the upper middle classes, the upper classes, things are so very expensive here that, for example, just to buy a pair of sort of name brand sneakers is $300 at most regular department stores, which is extraordinary in a lot of ways. So what we're seeing here is, you know, airlines, you can take up to five bags on American Airlines that are 70 pounds each, two of them for free. And you see Brazilians when you fly back with them, you know, they have these enormous bundles of everything that they've, you know, bought in the United States, and they're taking back to Brazil simply because the choice is better, the quality is better, and the prices are a lot cheaper.
Brazil really is entering the world stage in the next couple of years because of some big global events, the 2014 World Cup and the 2016 Summer Olympics. What does Brazil get out of these big investments that it's making in its infrastructure and cultural institutions to host the world events over the next 2 years?
It's interesting. One Brazilian told me yesterday, you know, we know how to throw a great party. So that's not a problem. What they're really worried about is when the bill comes in, what the hangover of that party is going to be. And what we haven't seen Brazilians say is investment in infrastructure. So we're going to have these great stadiums, but where are the train lines? Where are the subway systems? Where are the roads? Where are the improvements to the airports? And that's something that really concerns people here.
And are those events also making Brazilians think in a larger sense about the problems they've still got to tackle if they really do want to become the developed country that they feel that they're on the cusp of becoming? For example, you know, if you want to invest in Brazil, you've got structural problems that you have to deal with still, taxes, Baroque red tape. But also on a social level, you know, violent crime in many ways is worse in Brazil than even in Mexico. But how are Brazilians responding to the need to confront those larger problems?
There is high crime, and not only just high crime, but very violent crime. We just saw also last week, you know, a woman who was set on fire because the criminals didn't think that she had enough money in her current account. She only had $15 there in her checking account. And so they basically torched her and killed her because she couldn't provide them with enough funds. I mean, this really shocks the people here. And so there is an underlying concern about we're having this prosperity, we're seeing the country moving forward, and yet we're still seeing incredibly high crime. We're seeing impunity. People don't get prosecuted. People don't go to prison for the crimes that they commit. And there's an enormous amount of corruption.
So, Lourdes, compare that, a kind of undermining of the confidence with fighting crime, to what we mentioned earlier, which was the growing confidence that Brazilians have in their place in the global economy.
And perhaps even a sense of being really the hemisphere's first counterweight to U.S. power in the Americas.
I think certainly Brazil is a counterweight to the United States. It's not a counterweight in the same way that, let's say, Hugo Chavez tried to be of Venezuela. They're not anti-American. Their rhetoric certainly isn't of that nature. You don't hear a lot of anti-American rhetoric here. Certainly, Brazil, in their government and in their outlook, sees the world differently than perhaps the U.S. administration does. They're not as interventionist in things. They try to mediate more, and they have alliances with countries that are anti-American. And so we are seeing Brazil's expanding power, and that, you know, is soft power in terms of goodwill, but that is also, you know, their corporations. We have Odebrecht here, which is sort of the Halliburton of Brazil, which is an enormous company that does construction and works in petrochemicals, and they're involved in all sorts of things all through Latin America and in Africa. So, you know, we are seeing Brazil sort of leverage that in parts of the world where perhaps the United States has not enjoyed such goodwill.
Lourdes, finally tell us, how much are those tomatoes?
Well, the price went crazy, and people were smuggling tomatoes over the border from Argentina, as well as onions, and now the price has gone down again. But we are seeing these enormous spikes in foodstuffs and other things, and that really is a concern for people. You know, I went to the market the other day, and someone was telling me, you know, tomatoes, onions, it's the price of gold.
Lourdes, muito obrigado. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Lourdes Garcia Navarro, NPR in São Paulo, Brazil. And just correcting, the Brazilian economy fell below 1% growth last year, did not actually fall into a recession. Join the conversation, WLRN.org, on Twitter, at WLRN. Use the hashtag SunshineEconomy. And still to come on the Sunshine Economy, the Americas and Miami, how Cuba fits into the changing relationship.
Two other areas of great interest to the Chinese are Central and South America, and Chinese investments in that part of the world are rapidly expanding.
Commodity prices are relatively high and are predicted to remain so. This means South American economies are less dependent on the United States.
The big trend between China and Latin America over the last 10 years has been trade growth. Now it's all about investment, and it's increasing.
It's the Sunshine Economy, the Americas, and Miami on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Tim Padgett.
Now, the insatiable demand for raw materials worldwide, especially in China, has pushed China's annual trade with Latin America from less than $10 billion, Tim, back at the turn of the century, almost $250 billion today. Just 4 years ago, China actually replaced the United States as Brazil's number one trade partner.
And yet, the numbers don't bear out this argument that that somehow China is that we're letting that Washington is letting China take over in the Western Hemisphere. In 2012, for example, U.S. Latin American trade in goods alone hit a record $843 billion. Latin American countries buy 25% of our exports; we buy 40% of theirs, and we provide just as much of their foreign investment.
So these are the numbers behind this changing relationship. Carol Wise from the University of Southern California is with us from Los Angeles to talk about her perspective on just how worried the U.S. should be about China's incursion into the Americas. Carol, as you look at this three-way trade dynamic happening between Latin America, the United States, Latin America, and China, what's at risk for the U.S. relationship with Latin America as China does more and more business?
I think the risk for the U.S. is just benign neglect and not really tuning in as much as it could to some of the opportunities. And what I mean by this is that if you look at the investments that we make from the United States and you look at the ones that China's making, it's very complementary. China's mainly investing right now in big infrastructure that gets products to the ports, gets products to, you know, out of the Amazon, across Peru, across the Pacific. So we basically are in services, manufacturing, much higher value added, higher sort of skill intensive kinds of investments. So there's a lot of complementary there, and I think that we could actually be cashing in much more on some of these investments where the Chinese have been instrumental in laying down the infrastructure.
Now, Carol, you've got a book coming out, and if you could remind me of the title.
Well, it's The Political Economy of China-Latin American Relations in the 21st Century.
Uh-huh. And is it really fair, though, to say that China is taking over in America's own backyard, as many people put it?
No, and if we look, I don't think so at all, quite frankly. And if we look at what actual percentage of trade, say Brazil. Now, Brazil is trading so vigorously with China, as you mentioned in your intro to this segment. But it's probably only about 14-15% of Brazil's total trade, right?
Uh-huh.
So the numbers are exploding. The leap forward in terms of Chinese participation in the region has been phenomenal over the last decade, but it still is dwarfed by the U.S. presence economically, especially in Central America and Mexico.
And you've also pointed out in your writings that Latin America better be careful, because even though they're making quite a bonanza on selling commodities to China, China is making Latin America buy a lot of its manufactured goods, and that is really putting a stunt on Latin America's ability to create a more high-tech economy.
Well, and is that crowding out, Carol, U.S. products in the Latin American market?
I think it would be very hard for China to be crowding out some U.S. products, particularly in the area of services, high-tech, data processing, a lot of the things that our investors have been so interested in, for example, since these free trade agreements have been signed with Peru, Chile, recently Colombia, Costa Rica, and whatnot. So, no, we're not getting crowded out. But I do think that I really enjoyed the interview with the Brazilian colleague in talking about Brazil's situation with massive commodity sales to China, but sluggish growth. And I think we're going to start seeing some more of that, because on the one hand, China's entry into Brazil is forcing Brazilians, Mexicans, all producers across the region in the manufacturing sector to really restructure in a more compelling way than they've had to probably ever. I mean, globalization is no longer something that the Brazilian and the Mexican producers can truly insulate themselves from. This is what all the cries for protectionism have been about, right? So I think it's very good that the Chinese manufacturing imports from China are just exploding. It's been very difficult on both these economies, Mexico and Brazil. But these sluggish growth rates mean that you've got to open it up more. You've got to restructure. The Brazilian service sector is almost completely closed. Mm. That's not competitive.
It's the triangulation of world trade between China, Latin America, and the United States with Carol Wise of the University of Southern California. Still ahead on the Sunshine Economy, can South Florida remain the business gateway to Latin America?
We all want democracy. I get along perfectly well with other activists who are in favor of the embargo, but I am against the embargo for several reasons. Perhaps because I was born on an island where propaganda about the embargo was very virulent, and because I realized over time that the Cuban government uses the embargo as a justification for everything.
It's the Sunshine Economy, the Americas, and Miami. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Tim Padgett.
That is the Cuban blogger and dissident Joanny Sanchez being interviewed by Miami journalist Maria Elvira Salazar during her recent visit to the United States, really opposing not only the island's dictatorship, Tim, but becoming really the voice of the new generation thinking about U.S.-Cuba relations.
Right. And on the phone to help us understand why we're not engaging communist Cuba in the same way that we engage, for example, communist China, is Miami Herald columnist Andres Oppenheimer, one of the most venerated journalists in the Americas, and the author of books such as Saving the Americas and Castro's Final Hour, one of the best books written about the Cuban situation.
Yeah, Andres will join us in mere moments. You know, what's interesting about this relationship, Tim, is here in South Florida, for a long time, looking at that Latin American relationship has been through the lens of looking at the long-term relationship and the trade embargo that the United States has on Cuba.
Well, it's like immigration in the sense. This is one of those issues where the rest of Latin America looks at how we deal with Cuba as sort of a gauge of how we treat the rest of the region. Now, whether that's fair or not, you can debate, but it's a fact. And they see our refusal to engage Cuba as sort of a tacit refusal to engage the rest of the region.
Andres joins us now. Andres, is that lens of Cuba, is it distorting opportunities between U.S. and Latin America looking ahead to this so-called century of the Americas?
Not as much as it used to, because really, right now, nobody's in a rush to see things changing rapidly in Cuba. You posed a question earlier about whether the U.S. was in any hurry to change things in Cuba, and I really think there's sort of a political diplomatic paralysis, because on the U.S. side, the Obama administration is focused on China, on the Far East. They have said so publicly when they declared that, you know, the U.S. is a Pacific power, the Obama administration is in no rush to change things in Cuba because of fear of another Mariel boat lift. You may remember
right. That's
the big mass immigration that hurt so much the Carter administration. And our neighbors are not that interested either because, you know, Mexico, Central America, the Caribbean, they don't want Cuba to open up and get all the American tourists. So really, nobody except the Cubans on the islands, perhaps, is in a real rush to see a big change in Cuba. So the attitude among governments, although they never say so publicly, of course, is, you know, let's wait until Fidel Castro dies and things to sort out themselves, and why rush now?
But then, Andres, real quick, why then did the rest of Latin America make such a big stink about Cuba at the last Summit of the Americas?
They really don't. I mean, it's sort of a nice way for presidents to throw a bone to their left wing within their own parties.
Right.
It's sort of a domestic issue. But they really, seriously, when they meet with the U.S. officials, the last thing they care about is Cuba.
Andres Oppenheimer with the Miami Herald. Always great to speak with you and get that perspective, Andres. Tim, here, as we're looking at this century of the Americas, a half century old now, your thoughts after 25 years of coverage of this idea, where does it, can it grow from here?
Well, I think at this point, as I said before, I think Obama's trip over the weekend showed that despite the fact that Latin America has come into its own and is independent of the United States now, that doesn't mean that we can just disconnect ourselves from the region. It means all the more that we have to learn how to engage that.
Well, next Monday here on WLRN, the Sunshine Economy, it's Diagnosis Healthcare in South Florida. Are healthcare jobs as secure as they once were? We will be talking with the CEOs of top hospitals in our area and hear the warning from a top health insurance boss.
Older people in general will get a break on their price, and younger people will get a dramatic increase in the cost of their rates because they're now in a pool with older people.
You'll hear that warning next week here on WLRN, Monday morning, 9 a.m., the Sunshine Economy, Diagnosis Healthcare in South Florida. We'll be talking with CEOs of South Florida hospitals, insurance companies, and medical device manufacturers talking about this important industry here in our region. Finally, Tim, one of the newest areas U.S. trade officials are putting money behind to promote in Latin America is not a new export at all. It's American rock and roll, believe it or not, putting tax money to work here, specifically music from independent music labels, trying to get more distribution and more sales throughout Latin America. Labels like ATO Records, in this band, the Alabama Shakes, trying to get more trade between the Americas and Latin America. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.
Got to hold.